This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome. Welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington. Coming up on Africa News Tonight...
They're very aware of what happened in Algeria as well as Egypt. And one of the things they want to do is to prevent a situation where elements within the military hijack this process.
That's Paul Nantulia, analyst at the National Defense University's Africa Center for Strategic Studies. On protesters in Sudan, details coming up also. According to the UN, this is the first time in known history that Mozambique has been hit by two cyclones in one season. And the U.S. has made it clear that it opposes the military offensive by General Khalifa Haftar's self-styled Libyan National Army. We'll have these stories and lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight. Our top story, powerful tropical cyclone Kenneth has made landfall in Mozambique just 6 weeks after cyclone Idai, which made landfall further south, flattened the port city of Beira, killing more than 1,000 people. According to a United Nations spokesman, this is the first time in known history that Mozambique has been hit by two cyclones in one season. To update us on the latest on Cyclone Kenneth, we have in studio Ananacio Miguel from VOA's Portuguese to Africa service. Welcome to Africa News Tonight.
Thank you very much.
What is the latest trajectory of the cyclone on impoverished Mozambique, still recovering from a previous powerful storm?
Well, at this time, authorities, they're still... saying that at least one person died yesterday when this storm hit Mozambique. Some other sources that they say there was at least other two people were killed. Seems like according to the reports that we have, that this time the government has a better response to the emergence, learning from the experience in Beira, which was hit some 4 weeks ago by another cyclone, which was Idai. Many houses were destroyed. Infrastructures were also destroyed. Many roads in the area of Cabo Delgado are destroyed, and also they're facing some problems with telecommunications. As you said in your initial report, like experts are wondering why Mozambique was hit in less than a month by two storms, and UN experts are heading to Mozambique to try to analyze that situation. Another important issue of the response led by the government and some other organization is like during this week, government forced people to move out from this area so that they can be in a safer place, and this seems to be working very well. But the thing is, the rain is continuing. At least they say it will be two times more compared to the one that we saw in Beira. So the impact will be coming in the next days.
I'm glad you mentioned the storms. The UN Humanitarian Agency says more than 680,000 people are at risk from the latest storm. There are concerns that five rivers and coastal waterways could burst their banks, leading to severe flooding.
And not only that, it leads to severe flooding, and also crops were destroyed. So this is bringing another issues. This province of Cabo Delgado in the last 2 years has been affected by this movement of insurgents who have been attacking poor people in poor village. So adding to that, there will be a famine because people will not be able to produce for themselves. So they will be relying on food aid. Poor people facing many problems at the same time. And also, another important point is this thing, like in less than 2 months, Mozambique is hit by two very, very hard cyclones. So this is another thing that we need to explain. And also, making the country aware of this change that's happening and also how to deal with this in the future. And the UN has been also calling the international community to scale up support, but knowing that even the situation in Beira is still not sound in terms of finance.
And a little before we conclude, Cabo Delgado province, which has seen a rise in deadly arm attacks, and that's one of the places the cyclone hit the most.
Exactly.
So yeah, how are things over there? Right,
things are not fine now, because these people have been facing this group of armed people that killed at least 200 people in the last 2 years, and now they have this situation of storm. People were forced to run away from their village, and now they run away to hide because of the this climate situation. So one of the major concerns will be like famine. There won't be food for these people. School year has been disrupted, so it's a dire situation.
Ananacio Miguel from VOA's Portuguese service, thanks you for your input.
Thank you. See you next time.
For the past 2 weeks, protesters in Sudan have demanded the military hand over power to civilians, and talks appear to be making some progress. Meanwhile, the protesters are directing their anger at a new target, Arab governments, for what they say is interference in Sudan's internal affairs. Naba Mohadin reports from Khartoum that protesters were outside the Egyptian embassy yesterday, saying they don't need outsiders telling them what to do. Activists ramped up social media campaigns today, calling for more protesters to rally outside embassies and consulates. Such sentiments have been brewing among protesters since a joint Saudi Emirate delegation visited Sudan on April 16th. The visit raised eyebrows as it came just days after the military ousted President Omar al-Bashir from 3 decades of power. The delegation announced $3 billion in aid, which was welcomed by the military but rejected by protesters suspicious of their past support for Bashir and other Islamist and authoritarian leaders. At Friday prayers in Khartoum, religious leaders told crowds of protesters outside army headquarters to refuse intervention from foreign countries. Political analyst Al-Fiti Mahmoud says Bashir's removal has raised concerns among Gulf states that Turkey and Qatar could gain new influence in Sudan. Sudan's military, which took over after ousting President Omar al-Bashir, says it intends to keep the upper hand during the transition to civilian rule. Shams al-Din al-Kabshi, the spokesman for the military council, said late yesterday that the military will maintain sovereign powers while the cabinet would be in the hands of civilians until elections are held. The announcement was a blow to the protesters, who said they would stay on the streets until all their demands are met. They want a transitional council with limited military representation to run the country, along with an interim cabinet until a new constitution is drafted. Paul Nanatulia, an analyst at the National Defense University's Africa Center for Strategic Studies, spoke to VOA senior analyst Mohamed El-Shenawi about the tug of war between the army and the protesters.
I see this as part of the ongoing negotiations between the military leadership in Khartoum and the Sudan Professionals Alliance and the coalitions that are pushing for the establishment of a transitional civil authority. But what is interesting as we observe this process is that the military leadership does not seem to have a structure in place. For the most part, they appear to be reacting to the proposals that are being put forward by the Sudan Professionals Association. What they're calling for is a transitional structure that has 3 elements. The first is a presidential council consisting of technocrats and experts that will carry out the day-to-day functions and responsibility of the government. That will be supported by an expanded council of ministers that again will be run by professionals from the different coalitions that make up what they call their civil resistance. And then the third element is a civil statutory council, which is a legislative structure in which women will be represented no less than 40%. And youth and women will also have quarters in that legislative structure. So this is the structure of the government that is being envisioned by the SPA and its allies. And so the concessions that the military leadership has offered at the moment do not satisfy this structure. And this is the reason why the coalition as a whole has refused to accept these demands and is insisting on pressing on with their sitting outside the Ministry of Defense headquarters.
The Sudanese Professionals Association also rejected the three-month extension of the deadline offered by the African Union to hand over power to a civilian government.
Correct.
Which side can win this tug of war?
I spoke with one of the individuals that is involved with all these processes on the ground in Khartoum, and they say that they're very disappointed with the position of the African Union. Nevertheless, the African Union has reiterated its call for the transfer of power to a civilian authority. So that is the one thing. They've been able to see that. The other interesting observation that they make is that they have more leverage to influence developments on the ground than the African Union. They are going to continue with the different protests that are taking place, and not just in Khartoum, but also other cities like Omdurman and other places. And we saw early on today a convergence of thousands of protesters that are coming in from different parts of the country to continue to apply that pressure. So what they think is that they do have the levers that they need to be able to apply pressure, to focus the regional and international community, and to drive that process in ways that the African Union probably can't. But having said that, they have acknowledged that the AU has not abandoned its call for the transfer of power to a civil authority. So I think they sound pretty confident, but there's also a cautious optimism. They're very aware of what happened in Algeria as well as Egypt. And one of the things they want to do is to prevent a situation where elements within the military hijack this process. And what they want to do is to prevent that situation from happening. So that's why you see insistence that the civil protest and civil pressure must continue.
Rosalind Marsden, a former British ambassador to Sudan, said Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates have made it clear that they are supporting the military council, and the protesters urged Sudan's neighbors to stay out of its internal affairs. Would some regional powers lead a counter-revolution in Sudan?
Well, that is the fear. And right from the start of these protests, the SPA and its coalitions made it very clear that they would want the regional and international community, as well as international partners, to play a role that would enable and assist a civilian-led transition in the country. And they made it very clear. And, you know, the statements that came out yesterday, as well as the day before yesterday, where they are rejecting any form of engagement that puts its support behind any one of the factions that are maneuvering and are jostling for power within the military leadership. So it is a concern. We've seen a very negative reaction to the humanitarian assistance that was ostensibly sent by the United Arab Emirates. I mean, this was rejected, and it was followed up by multiple statements where the coalitions have said that they do not want any of the regional and international partners to play a role that would cause divisions within the opposition or support any one faction within the military.
That was Paul Nantulia, an analyst at the National Defense University's Africa Center for Strategic Studies, speaking with VOA senior analyst Mohamed El-Shenawi. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo says the U.S. has made clear that it opposes the military offensive by General Khalifa Haftar's self-styled Libyan National Army and is urging the immediate halt to the assault on the capital, stressing there is no military solution to the conflict. However, President Donald Trump acknowledged Haftar's role in combating terrorism and maintaining Libya's resources. Libyan-American organizations are calling on U.S. policymakers to take a clear stance against dictatorship and military rule in Libya. Issa Momish, president of the Libyan American Alliance, spoke to VOA senior analyst Mohamed El-Shenawi about the reasons behind such calls and the different scenarios that can emerge from the military campaign against Tripoli.
there is ambivalence within the American policy given the president's call to the warlord Haftar as well as Bolton's call to him earlier. We felt that there was very much synchrony in the U.S. Government's stance when Secretary Pompeo was very clear to oppose the military offensive by Khalifa Haftar's forces, urging them to an immediate halt to these military operations. We saw that also with DOD and AFRICOM and everybody looking for stability in Libya through a negotiated political settlement. Everybody was against the military solution to Libya. What Haftar did was a severe derailment to this conflict. However, in the last week or so, we saw these messages, especially after the visit of President Sisi of Egypt to Washington and the undue influence of the United Arab Emirates. It unfortunately has placed the Libyan situation in a severe situation given the fact that Haftar was called and was commended for his efforts on counterterrorism, which is a fallacy because that will even worsen the situation in Libya in that stance. And also thinking that he would be the one who can deliver stability and democracy in Libya is wrongly misconstrued.
Some analysts believe that the phone call President Trump made and acknowledgement of General Haftar's role in combating terrorism and maintaining Libya's resources emboldened Haftar and encouraged him to continue his military push. Do you share this assessment?
Unfortunately and sadly, yes, because it was made into a media blitz where it showed that in the least, the U.S. is not working to stop him from his attack on Tripoli. It did embolden his supporters, and it did give him a sense of righteousness in completing what he thought he was doing. The fact is he's being defeated on the ground. The fact is that he is the very source of instability in Libya that will bring about worse terrorism and that will threaten the oil markets and create a vacuum that will create problems for the strategic allies of the U.S. in southern Europe.
So how do you explain the division in the Security Council, which prevented the Council from issuing any resolution to stop the military campaign against Tripoli?
The U.S. was in line initially with the U.K.'s approach to condemning the attack and calling everybody to come back to the political roundtable. However, it is true that in the last week after President Trump's call to Haftar, there has been some reluctance in the clarity of the U.S. position, and thus they took their stance in the U.N. Security Council along with Russia to withhold any support for the resolution. We see this as a grave mistake. We see this as a very dangerous signal that could put Libya in a very long civil war that will not produce the results of the U.S. interest that we are looking to achieve.
So what are the possible scenarios judging from what's happening now in Libya?
Scenario one is consistent with what we see in the ground today, that the Government of National Accord Army was able to defeat Haftar's attack, at least stop it, and Haftar has regressed over 60 kilometers away from Tripoli. I think that if the level of victory continues, I think we can see a sustained success by the army of the Government of National Accord to achieve some sort of stability in the western region. But the other scenario would be for this to become a continued stalemate, unfortunately, because not only because of the size of the forces of the militias of Haftar, but also because of the continued support of nations such as Egypt or the UAE of that military offensive, and the fact that countries like France and Russia are still invested in the success of Haftar, and that can create sources of sustainability of this conflict, and that would be very disastrous. I think it will create a vacuum in leadership and a space that will cause the flourishing of terrorism and instability of the region. The last scenario of Haftar winning, I think, is very slim. I think despite the fact that he may be supported by strong regional allies, the fact is that the level of resistance in the West is far bigger than anything that Haftar can overcome and take over, or if the West and the international players and the UN is able to call on everybody to retreat to their pre-offensive lines and come back to the negotiation table, I think that may create some solution out of this current very serious conflict.
That was Issa Momish, president of the Libyan American Alliance, speaking to VOA's Mohammed Al-Shenawi. Lack of access to electricity is hampering the delivery of quality healthcare services to millions across Africa. Experts meeting in Nairobi this week are urging governments and private investors to tap into renewable energy to provide reliable power supply to community health care centers and clinics in poor rural areas. From the Kenyan capital, VOA's Ruben Chama reports.
The United Nations Foundation, in conjunction with the UK's Department for International Development, DFID, and other partners, organized the two-day conference. It brought together key energy experts, policymakers, medical practitioners, and healthcare professionals to promote clean energy solutions in empowering health systems in Africa. Jim Pokaro is a senior director of energy access at the United Nations Foundation.
There's abundant hydro resources, hydropower, wind. There's a whole range of clean energy solutions, but the one in particular that really is most abundant here is solar. The popularity of solar has become much more popular because the cost of solar has dropped about 92% in the last decade alone, which is opening up all sorts of new opportunities to actually use this power in a more productive way.
He says one in four health facilities in sub-Saharan Africa lacks access to electricity, and three in four facilities lack reliable power.
And even those health facilities that do have power often rely on very dirty, inefficient, and costly sources of energy like diesel generators and the grid that constantly is going out due to power outages. And all of this is basically resulting in poor quality health services. So the potential that clean energy has is to provide a cleaner, more cost-effective, and more reliable way of actually powering health facilities and therefore actually contributing to better quality health services.
Dr. Maria Neira, Director of Public Health and Environment at the World Health Organization, says raising awareness among policymakers about the role that renewable energy and energy efficiency play in creating stronger and more resilient health systems is critical.
For us, access to clean energy is a fundamental part of access to health. If you don't have clean energy at the healthcare facilities, you will not be able to perform a good care for your patients. You will not be able to keep a vaccine on a refrigerator. You will not be able to provide a surgical services or helping a woman to deliver a baby. Many functions with not be possible.
Lack of power also limits the hours of operation and the retention of rural health workers and undermines the provision of adequate water, sanitation and hygiene. According to the UN Environment, 1 billion people lack access to basic energy infrastructure, but with solar panels, poor households can get access to simple and cost-effective energy solutions. A large segment of Africa's population is keeping the connection to the traditional non-renewable energy grid and going straight to solar energy. Julius Pion is a clinical officer at a community health center in a remote village in Suswa, Kenya's Rift Valley area.
Since the time we received the solar panel, the community has benefited a lot. The percentage of immunization has gone high. We reach each and every child not able to visit the facility. We are serving a 75% of rate of immunization yearly.
The clinic utilizes a solar-powered, environmentally sustainable off-the-grid refrigeration for its vaccinations, profoundly influencing the rural community. Using renewable energy solutions for healthcare is also gaining ground in other countries such as Rwanda. The two-day Nairobi meeting, aimed at building a coalition in support of global action on clean energy and healthcare, as well as exchanging knowledge and practical experiences in delivering energy services to health facilities in resource-constrained environments. Ruben Chama, VOA News, Nairobi.
And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Yehiz Wuhib in Washington.
Hello, this is Peter Clotty, host of Nightline Africa. Please join us every Saturday and Sunday at 16 and 18 hours UTC. Nightline Africa is VOA's Africa's weekend show that provides news, features, and entertainment news about Africa and the world. Tune in. You will be glad you did. I guarantee it.